Chapter 51. The world's highest pig farm, we hired the only guide left to lead us on our way. He was over 70, but he could have given me 9/10 of his strength, and still had all his age entitled him to. He shouldered our satchels, overcoats, and alpenstocks, and we set out up the steep path. It was hot work. The old man soon begged us to hand over our coats and waistcoats to him to carry to, and we did it. One could not refuse so little a thing to a poor old man like that. He should have had them, if he had been 150. When we began that ascent, we could see a microscopic chalet perched away up against heaven on what seemed to be the highest mountain near us. It was on our right, across the narrow head of the valley. But when we got up abreast it on its own level, mountains were towering high above on every hand, and we saw that its altitude was just about that of the little Gesternthal which we had visited the evening before. Still it seemed a long way up in the air, in that waste and lonely wilderness of rocks. It had an unfenced grass plot in front of it which seemed about as big as a billiard table, and this grass plot slanted so sharply downward, and was so brief, and ended so exceedingly soon at the verge of the absolute precipice, that it was a shuddery thing to think of a person's venturing to trust his foot on an incline so situated at all. Suppose a man stepped on an orange peel in that yard, there would be nothing for him to seize. Nothing could keep him from rolling. 5 revolutions would bring him to the edge, and over he would go. What a frightful distance he would fall! For there are very few birds that fly as high as his starting point. He would strike and bounce 2 or 3 times on his way down, but this would be no advantage to him. I would as soon take an airing on the slant of a rainbow as in such a front yard. I would rather, in fact, for the distance down would be about the same, and it is pleasanter to slide than to bounce. I could not see how the peasants got up to that chalet. The region seemed too steep for anything but a balloon. As we strolled on, climbing up higher and higher, we were continually bringing neighboring peaks into view and lofty prominence which had been hidden behind lower peaks before. So by and by, while standing before a group of these giants, we looked around for the chalet again. There it was, away down below us, apparently on an inconspicuous ridge in the valley. It was as far below us, now, as it had been above us, when we were beginning the ascent. After a while the path led us along a railed precipice, and we looked over. Far beneath us was the snug parlor again, the little Gesternthal, with its water jets spouting from the face of its rock walls. We could have dropped a stone into it. We had been finding the top of the world all along and always finding a still higher top stealing into view in a disappointing way just ahead. When we looked down into the Gesternthal we felt pretty sure that we had reached the genuine top at last, but it was not so. There were much higher altitudes to be scaled yet. We were still in the pleasant shade of forest trees, we were still in a region which was cushioned with beautiful mosses, and aglow with the many-tinted luster of innumerable wild flowers. We found, indeed, more interest in the wild flowers than in anything else. We gathered a specimen or two of every kind which we were unacquainted with, so we had sumptuous bouquets. But one of the chief interests lay in chasing the seasons of the year up the mountain, and determining them by the presence of flowers and berries which we were acquainted with. For instance, it was the end of August at the level of the sea. In the Candlestick Valley at the base of the pass, we found flowers which would not be due at the sea level for 2 or 3 weeks. Higher up, we entered October, and gathered fringed gentians. I made no notes, and have forgotten the details, but the construction of the floral calendar was very entertaining while it lasted. In the high regions we found rich store of the splendid red flower, called the Alpine Rose, but we did not find any examples of the ugly Swiss favorite called Edelweiss. Its name seems to indicate that it is a noble flower, and that it is white. It may be noble enough, but it is not attractive, and it is not white. The fuzzy blossom is the color of bad cigar ashes, and appears to be made of a cheap quality of gray plush. It has a noble and distant way of confining itself to the high altitudes, but that is probably on account of its looks. It apparently has no monopoly of those upper altitudes, however, for they are sometimes intruded upon by some of the loveliest of the valley families of wildflowers. Everybody in the Alps wears a sprig of Edelweiss in his hat. It is the native's pet, and also the tourist's. All the morning, as we loafed along, having a good time, other pedestrians went staving by us with vigorous strides, and with the intent and determined look of men who were walking for a wager. These wore loose-knee breeches, long yarn stockings, and hobnailed high-laced walking shoes. They were gentlemen who would go home to England or Germany and tell how many miles they had beaten the guidebook every day. But I doubted if they ever had much real fun outside of the mere magnificent exhilaration of the tramp through the green valleys and the breezy heights, for they were almost always alone, and even the finest scenery loses incalculably when there is no one to enjoy it with. All the morning an endless double procession of mule-mounted tourists filed past us along the narrow path, the one procession going, the other coming. We had taken a good deal of trouble to teach ourselves the kindly German custom of saluting all strangers with doffed hat, and we resolutely clung to it that morning, although it kept us bareheaded most of the time, and was not always responded to. Still, we found an interest in the thing, because we naturally liked to know who were English and Americans among the passers-by. All continental natives responded, of course. So did some of the English and Americans, but, as a general thing, these two races gave no sign. Whenever a man or a woman showed us cold neglect, we spoke up confidently in our own tongue, and asked for such information as we happened to need, and we always got a reply in the same language. The English and American folk are not less kindly than other races, they are only more reserved, and that comes of habit and education. In one dreary, rocky waste, away above the line of vegetation, we met a procession of 25 mounted young men, all from America. We got answering bows enough from these, of course, for they were of an age to learn to do in Rome as Rome does, without much effort. At one extremity of this patch of desolation, overhung by bare and forbidding crags which husbanded drifts of everlasting snow in their shaded cavities, was a small stretch of thin and discouraged grass, and a man and a family of pigs were actually living here in some shanties. Consequently, this place could be really reckoned as property. It had a money value, and was doubtless taxed. I think it must have marked the limit of real estate in this world. It would be hard to set a money value upon any piece of earth that lies between that spot and the empty realm of space. That man may claim the distinction of owning the end of the world, for if there is any definite end to the world, he has certainly found it. From here forward we moved through a storm-swept and smileless desolation. All about us rose gigantic masses, cracks, and ramparts of bare and dreary rock, with not a vestige or semblance of plant or tree or flower anywhere, or glimpse of any creature that had life. The frost and the tempests of unnumbered ages had battered and hacked at these cliffs, with a deathless energy, destroying them piecemeal, so all the region about their bases was a tumbled chaos of great fragments which had been split off and hurled to the ground. Soiled and aged banks of snow lay close about our path. The ghastly desolation of the place was as tremendously complete as if Dora had furnished the working plans for it. But every now and then, through the stern gateways around us, we caught a view of some neighboring majestic dome, sheathed with glittering ice, and displaying its white purity at an elevation compared to which ours was groveling and plebeian, and this spectacle always chained one's interest and admiration at once, and made them forget there was anything ugly in the world. I have just said that there was nothing but death and desolation in these hideous places, but I forgot. In the most forlorn and arid and dismal one of all, where the racked and splintered debris was thickest, where the ancient patches of snow lay against the very path, where the winds blew bitterest, and the general aspect was mournfulest and dreariest, and furthest from any suggestion of cheer or hope, I found a solitary wee forget-me-not flourishing away, not a droop about it anywhere, but holding its bright blue star up with the prettiest and gallantest air in the world, the only happy spirit, the only smiling thing, in all that grisly desert. She seemed to say, cheer up. As long as we are here, let us make the best of it. I judged as he had earned the right to a more hospitable place, so I plucked her up, and sent her to America to a friend who would respect her for the fight as he had made, all by her small self, to make a whole vast despondent alpine desolation stop breaking its heart over the unalterable, and hold up its head and look at the bright side of things for once. We stopped for a nooning at a strongly built little inn called the Schwerenbach. It sits in a lonely spot among the peaks, where it is swept by the trailing fringes of the cloud rack, and is rained on, and snowed on, and pelted and persecuted by the storms, nearly every day of its life. It was the only habitation in the whole Gemmi Pass. Close at hand, now, was a chance for a blood-curdling alpine adventure. Close at H, and was the snowy mass of the great Altals cooling its top knot in the sky and daring us to an ascent. I was fired with the idea, and immediately made up my mind, to procure the necessary guides, ropes, etc., and undertake it. I instructed Harris to go to the landlord of the inn, and set him about our preparations. Meantime, I went diligently to work to read up, and find out what this much talked of mountain climbing was like, and how one should go about it, for in these matters I was ignorant. I opened Mr. Hinkliffe's Summer Months Among the Alps, published 1857, and selected his account of his ascent of Monte Rosa. It began. It is very difficult to free the mind from excitement on the evening before a grand expedition. I saw that I was too calm, so I walked the room a while, and worked myself into a high excitement. But the book's next remark that the adventurer must get up at 2 in the morning came as near as anything to flatting it all out again. However, I reinforced it, and read on, about how Mr. Hinkliffe dressed by candlelight, and was soon down among the guides, who were bustling about in the passage, packing provisions, and making every preparation for the start, and how he glanced out into the cold clear night and saw, that the whole sky was blazing with stars, larger and brighter than they appear through the dense atmosphere breathed by inhabitants of the lower parts of the earth. They seemed actually suspended from the dark vault of heaven, and their gentle light shed a fairy-like gleam over the snow fields around the foot of the Matterhorn, which raised its stupendous pinnacle on high, penetrating to the heart of the Great Bear, and crowning itself with a diadem of his magnificent stars. Not a sound disturbed the deep tranquility of the night, except the distant roar of streams which rush from the high plateau of the St. Theodule Glacier, and fall headlong over precipitous rocks till they lose themselves in the mazes of the Gorner Glacier. He took his hot toast and coffee, and then about 3:30 his caravan of 10 men filed away from the Riffel Hotel, and began the steep climb. At 5:30 he happened to turn around, and beheld the glorious spectacle of the Matterhorn, just touched by the rosy-fingered morning, and looking like a huge pyramid of fire rising out of the barren ocean of ice and rock around it. Then the Breithorn and the Dent Blanche caught the radiant glow, but the intervening mass of Monte Rosa made it necessary for us to climb many long hours before we could hope to see the sun himself. Yet the whole air soon grew warmer after the splendid birth of the day. He gazed at the lofty crown of Monte Rosa, and the wastes of snow that guarded its steep approaches, and the chief guide delivered the opinion that no man could conquer their awful heights, and put his foot upon that summit. But the adventurers moved steadily on, nevertheless. They toiled up, and up, and still up. They passed the grand plateau. Then toiled up a steep shoulder of the mountain, clinging like flies to its rugged face, and now they were confronted by a tremendous wall from which great blocks of ice and snow were evidently in the habit of falling. They turned aside to skirt this wall, and gradually ascended until their way was barred by a maze of gigantic snow crevices. So they turned aside again, and began a long climb of sufficient steepness to make a zigzag course necessary. Fatigue compelled them to halt frequently, for a moment or two. At one of these halts somebody called out, "Look at Mont Blanc!" And we were at once made aware of the very great height we had attained by actually seeing the monarch of the Alps, and his attendant satellites right over the top of the Briathorn, itself at least 14,000 feet high. These people moved in single file, and were all tied to a strong rope, at regular distances apart, so that if one of them slipped on those giddy heights, the others could brace themselves on their alpenstocks, and save him from darting into the valley, thousands of feet below. By and by they came to an ice-coated ridge which was tilted up at a sharp angle, and had a precipice on one side of it. They had to climb this, so the guide in the lead cut steps in the ice with his hatchet, and as fast as he took his toes out of one of these slight holes, the toes of the man behind him occupied it. Slowly and steadily we kept on our way over this dangerous part of the ascent, and I dare say it was fortunate for some of us that attention was distracted from the head by the paramount necessity of looking after the feet. For, while on the left the incline of ice was so steep, that it would be impossible for any man to save himself. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.